Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and you are joining us for another episode of The Three Horsemen. This is going to be our holiday gift idea episode, where we're going to talk about neat things that are available for science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction fans out there. I am joined, as usual, by my two cohorts. Say hello, Mr. John Stevens.
Hello, Mr. John Stevens.
And how is John Stevens?
Ba-dum-bum. Psh. Thank you, folks. I'm here for at least an hour. I'm doing all right. I'm a little nervous about tonight's podcast because I have very dorky selections. So, you know.
Dorky?
Well, they're very dorky.
On this show?
I assure you, sir, they are quite dorky.
Excellent. We like dorky.
Somebody else. But I should do the whole spiel. I'm a columnist for SF Signal. I'm a writer. I write lots of stuff. I'm writing a couple of books right now. I'm a bookseller, father, raconteur, curmudgeon. There we go.
Your enthusiasm is overwhelming this evening, John.
Excellent. Excellent. My plan is working.
And compared to him, Mr. Happy is Mr. Fred Kish.
Oh, thank you. Hi, it's Fred Kish. I blog at Bernal Alpha. I'm on Twitter as @FredKish, and I'm on this podcast and sometimes on other podcasts.
I have to update your website on my personal link page. I still don't have it changed to Bernal Alpha yet.
That's okay. The other one's not going away yet.
Yeah. Well, and as I said, I'm Jeff Patterson. I appear here, other podcasts, and you can find me on Twitter, @JeffPatterson11, and I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. We are recording this episode on the day that we have learned that Doris Lessing has passed away. Though certainly not a shock, given her age, it's still a very sad affair for me. I was Canopus and Argus. I read probably way earlier than I should have in my life. I think I was still a teenager when I read it. Reread it again in my 30s, and all of the other books that would be considered science fiction in her mind. And I think that it was important that she recognized that what she was writing was, in fact, science fiction. She actually referred to mainstream fiction as being very parochial, and the fact that she got a Nobel Prize for her writing always made me very happy. It was very sad for me when I read that. So, are you boys Lessing fans?
Oh, yes. And she's also a, so I think I was pointed out today, she is the answer to a trivia question, who was both a guest of honor at Worldcon and the winner of the Nobel Prize.
Ah, very good.
Yep.
Yep, that's right. That's a great trivia question.
Yep.
Had not thought of that. So we got a few things that we're going to talk about tonight. Like I said, we are going to do the we're going to talk about our ideas for holiday shopping this year. But first of all, we want to talk to Fred because Fred attended HonorCon down in South Carolina, and I want to hear all about it.
It's my first convention since the '80s, or first science fiction convention. I've been to gaming conventions since then. Yes, I packed up my car very early on Halloween, as it turned out, and drove what turned out to be 14 hours to South Carolina to wonderful, let me just make sure I get the name right so no one gets insulted, Greenville, South Carolina, which looked more to me like a combination of Princeton and someplace in California than South Carolina. Drove through Washington, D.C., and as I was approaching the NSA employee off-ramp, I noticed a couple of black SUVs behind me with darkened windows, to which I said, nah, that can't be. But sure enough, they got off at that off-ramp. And then as I approached the Pentagon, my GPS exploded and died on me, and I'm like, oh, come on. It was an exciting ride.
Well, the fact that you're not a convention regular, I think you broke their pattern recognition, so you showed up on their radar. So.
That could be. I was mostly going down there. I mean, I am a fan of David Weber's, especially the Honor Harrington series. But a friend of mine, Chris Weave, is on what is known as Bureau 9, the group that has been helping David Weber find if he comes up with a way of shooting off, as they call it, a Weber full of missiles. They're the ones that are coming up with the ways that it gets controlled and the scientific justification for the drives and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's sort of like they're doing the Star Trek technical manual for his universe. So my friend Chris Weave invited me down to carry his briefcase and ply him with water, because he was running or being involved with the technical track. The convention had a technical track. It had a couple of writers' track. It had like a publisher's track where they had various publishers and authors come in. I think there were roughly 200 people there, and about 100 of them, at least, were all wearing uniforms at one point or the other.
Of course.
From the universe, which was a pretty astounding percentage. So I sat in on the technical track where we discussed things such as how you build a spaceship and how you control the Navy in space and how do you detect objects in space. And some of the people that were there, there was one gentleman who's actually active U.S. Navy. He essentially started at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday and ran until well after 5 o'clock that evening. He participated in every single panel that they ran on the technical track that day. And I think by the end of the day, he looked a little wrung out.
Just a little.
Just a little. And it was kind of odd. At one point on Saturday, they asked everyone who was wearing uniform to go out to the lobby of the hotel because it was kind of futuristic. It had all this like grid work, so it almost looked like you were on a space station. And there was a wedding there too, taking pictures, and they were taking pictures of the guy's uniform. And at one point, the people at the wedding, I think, had some of the people from the convention come over and get into the photos. Wow. And you would do things like there was a Subway sandwich shop right across the street, so of course everyone was going over there because the hotel food prices were,
a bit high. Food prices, yeah.
Yes. So, you know, you'd have 3, 4, 5, 6 guys wearing various Manticoran. Manticoran comes from the audio books. There's a story behind that. uniforms, and like at one point I was in there getting my lunch, and 3 or 4 guys were behind me, and this girl comes up to one of them, and she's like, What military are you in? Oh, I'm with the Royal Navy, and so on and so forth, stringing her along. So I stayed through Sunday, went to the dead dog party, got to meet Eric Flint, Chuck Gannon, who's a longtime game writer, but now a relatively recent fiction writer. Everyone that's involved with BU9, I met. Met David Weber, of course. Tony Weisskopf of Bain Books. Tony Daniels, who's a editor at Bain. And I even met a guy named Craig Gallant, who is with another podcast, The D6 Generation. And he has actually gotten to the point of writing for comic books and recently came out with his first book of fiction, which is set in a game universe. Unfortunately, there were only 2 copies of the book there at the convention, so I bought the first of the 2 copies, and he signed it for me. It's like, oh, look, I sold out at the convention. Yeah, well. And then Monday, drove back, which again was supposed to be like 11 hours, and turned out to be 14 because Route 81 got closed down due to a tractor-trailer accident that closed both the north and southbound sides. And met up with Mr. Patterson for dinner.
Yeah.
In some town somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
Winchester.
And met his lovely wife.
Winchester, Virginia is the gateway to West Virginia. So.
Ah, okay.
I didn't get to say my line.
Oh, go ahead. Now, go ahead. Say your line.
So, Fred, what's Jeff's wife like?
Well, John, funny you should ask. From listening to Jeff, I always pictured a combination of Lois Lane and Wonder Woman. But after meeting Jeff, I know she's actually a combination of Lois Lane, Wonder Woman, and Mother Teresa.
Excellent.
Oh, Lord.
Oh. No, she's very, very lovely person, and obviously has the patience of a saint to put up with him.
As do we all.
Yes.
Her and I have a saying that combined, we almost make up one competent person. We manage to survive through life through each other's wits. Almost. We still let things slip through once in a while. So.
Right.
That's fun. I'm glad you had a good time.
Yes, I did.
I really hope to one day encounter you in a convention setting, because that tends to be nerds in the wild when that happens, and I always enjoy the dynamic.
Or nerds gone wild, one of the
that's a different thing.
Well, I
can make comments about a number of conventions that have had problems in the last couple of years, but I will not. So
yes, this one was problem free.
Excellent.
I'm only aware of one technical glitch, even. So, you know, they for a first time as an organization running something, View 9 did a wonderful job. And I appreciate being invited and attending and being made welcome.
Excellent. It's so funny you make the comment about everybody in uniform. I still recall there was a big media convention up in Springfield, Mass., and there were all these people dressed up in Star Trek and Star Wars uniforms and a few other shows. And they all got called into the big banquet hall that they had there, where they were suddenly addressed by members of the Secret Service who were telling them that President Clinton was going to be speaking at the town square, which was about four blocks west of the hotel where the convention was. And in no uncertain terms, they were not invited. If they saw any Klingons approaching the political rally, they would be put into paddy wagons and hauled away, which I kind of wish had actually happened, because I'd love to see TV news footage of, you know, a group of Klingon warriors being hauled off. Excellent. So it's coming up on the end of November as we record this, and we are approaching Black Friday and Cyber Monday and the always dreaded holiday season. And we all tend to make in our minds little lists of things that both we would like to get and things that we would like to give to other people. And we wanted to throw some ideas out there. We always hear that nerds are very tough to buy for, and sometimes they're tough to buy for each other. And sometimes the individual circles on the Venn diagram of fandom tend to don't always intersect in a very informative way, so we wanted to throw some thoughts out there tonight and our thoughts on the subject. John, what do you got?
What do I got?
What do you got?
Well, let's see. I will now fulfill my promise of being a huge dork, because I'm going to recommend a couple of academic books. The gift you should give your loved ones at Christmas are academic books. Absolutely. Well, I'll start with the nonfiction first. So there's two books that are both, one's edited by and one's written by a prominent scholar named Brian Attenberry. And he has come out with an edited volume called Parabolas of Science Fiction, which is an attempt to rethink the way that we look at genre and science fiction. He's trying to get away from the kind of formulaic interpretations that we often see, especially for a lot of other genres, where, like, for mystery and romance, there are ideas of, like, there are certain plot structures and very common narrative devices you almost have to use in every one in order to make it that genre. His contention is science fiction isn't like that. It's actually, in some ways, much more open, and to try to make it a strictly define genre as a real problem. So the whole volume is a bunch of different authors that he's brought together trying to figure out different angles from which to look at science fiction and take it apart and make sense of it and see what it's telling us. And it's I've only read the introduction and the first two articles. I got the actually bought the book myself at ReaderCon. But it's really pretty remarkable because they're trying to rethink science fiction without falling prey to what we sometimes often do when we talk about the SF genre, and imbuing it with some sort of innate superiority to all other genres. I see this a lot, and this is especially true, much more perhaps in classical science fiction criticism, the idea that, you know, SF and fantasy, fantastica, whichever, you know, term you want to use, is somehow superior to other forms because it has some impugned elemental power to remake the world. And they're trying to figure out, you know, other ways to talk about it without falling prey to that particular conceit. So it's very well done. And as I said, Atterbury's been doing this for a long time. And he's actually done a great job of pulling this stuff together. And I like that as a gift idea. But also, he's written his own book called Stories About Stories, Fantasy and the Remaking of Myth, which is an attempt to tackle the fantasy genre. And his basic argument there is that, and we've kind of heard this before, the idea that, you know, contemporary fantasy is sort of a myth-making endeavor for the modern slash postmodern slash however you want to characterize it world. But he also does something that I haven't seen in a lot of other discussions of the fantasy genre. He goes back to not just sort of well-known antecedents of contemporary fantasy, but he goes back to the broader literary traditions that modern novel writing has emerged from and tries to tease out some of the different strands of narrative conventions and ideas, and argue not that we're doing exactly what classical mythology did, but we are trying to make up stories that help us make sense of the world. So he's taking this idea of myth as something that we engage in and that we generate in order to look at the world a little differently than quote-unquote a realist perspective. And that's what he tries to do in the book. So that's a good one too. And I've only read the introduction to that one as well, but one of the great things I like about Atterbury is that he is a scholar, but he doesn't go off into obfuscation land with his jargon. You know,
do we know anybody like that? Well done.
No, I don't know anyone who does that.
Yes. Moving on. So there are those two books. And then another nonfiction title that's actually of a different vein is a book that came out, I think, in July. It's called The Interpretation of Zines, A Pictorial History of Science Fiction Fanzines.
Ooh.
By Louis Ortiz.
Oh, you have me at hello.
It is by a very small press, and it does not, unfortunately, have an electronic version that I'm aware of. And I don't know a lot about it, but it looks very promising just from the blurb. And from the fact that what he's trying to do is, first of all, show you physically what zines look like, but is also trying to do a new history of them. And he's going, you know, back to as far back to the beginning as possible. He talks about Ray Bradbury, for example, who started out actually as a fanzine editor. One of the first things he did as he was writing his early stories was he was an editor of several fanzines. And he tries to sort of rebuild the history, but he's doing it sounds like, with a lot of visual aid so that you get a fuller sense of what it was like, not just to read the history, but actually see what people were reading and see what it looked like and see how zines have actually changed over the years. I don't know how far up in history he comes, but it sounds like he comes pretty close to the present day, and it sounds like a very promising book. And it's not terribly expensive either, so I think it would be a good gift idea.
Yeah.
What else?
Is that on Amazon?
That is on Amazon. It has not actually been released yet.
Okay.
Actually, I'm just looking at the page now. It's going to be released around Thanksgiving.
Okay.
But I've already got that in my shopping cart. And I think it's something that would be great for, you know, the hardcore science fiction fan. or anyone who's interested in literary, you know, the history of literary production in the genre.
You heard it here first, folks. The guy who works for an independent bookstore shops at Amazon.
Well, I do work at a used bookstore. So, you know.
Okay.
Anyway, so what else? So, another book is something that I found out about when it was being kickstarted, but it wasn't on Kickstarter. I think it might have been Indiegogo that I got it on. I forget. But it's a book called Mothership, Tales from Afrofuturism and Beyond. And it's edited by Bill Campbell and Edward Austin Hall. And it's a compendium of stories with, as they say, African themes, but themes involving African cultures, African societies, projecting futures in Africa, and Africa's impact on the future. And it's a great fiction collection. It is all reprints, some quite recent, but it's a really well done mix of stuff. They've got authors from Junot Diaz to Tobias Buckle to Lauren Bukes, N.K. Jemisin, Sophia Samater. It's a really, really variegated collection. And that's one that I've been going through slowly, reading a story at a time. And it's not just impressive writing, but it's great to read something that's really different from what you usually see. I think Campbell and Hall done a great job of pulling together some first-rate stories that are really entertaining and also really different. So I highly recommend that, too. It's just come out in paperback and hardcover and is available from your, you know, fine used bookseller, hopefully. But again, it's a smaller press. It's Rosarium Publishing is the company that put it out. But like I said, whatever it's so far, I've really liked, and I'm looking forward to finishing it off slowly and savoring it. And I think that would be a nice, somewhat unusual from the norm kind of collection to give somebody.
Yeah.
And I'd actually love to see more of that stuff in the future, those kind of collections. I mean, we've had stuff like the Apex Books of World SF, yep, which have been a nice variety of stuff from all over the place. But one of the things I like about this is the focus, while it may sound narrow at first read, actually conceals a huge amount of variety. And like I said, the stories are not just well done. They're just really something that you don't see every day. And it's really gratifying to read this kind of stuff and see it well done.
Yeah, I remember when the feature is Japanese, it ended up being a much, much... Mm-hmm. wider net that it threw than I expected it to be. So
right, exactly. So and this is, yeah, this sounds like it may be somewhat along this a similar lines in terms of how it works out. So there's that, and what else did I have? And I had one thing for the kids. Kazu Kibuishi, I may not be pronouncing his name right, I apologize, who has written and illustrated the Amulet series of graphic novels.
Right.
Has also edited a couple of volumes of short graphic fiction for kids around middle school age called the Explorer series. And I'm actually looking at getting the first volume, which is called The Mystery Boxes. Perhaps as a gift for my daughter. It's like I said, it's a fiction anthology. I guess it's kind of like the Flight series. Mm. So it's different writers and artists, and the theme is mystery boxes. So boxes that contain something and you don't know what they are, and the stories are all about what happens when people open the boxes. Mm. So it's an interesting thematic in that it doesn't really determine too much other than the fact that there's a mystery to be addressed, and the cover art is pretty gorgeous, and it sounds really interesting in terms of bringing a variety of perspectives in one volume to kids. I mean, most kids' books that are picture books or illustrated or even graphic novels are often from a single artist, single writer, and introducing shorter graphic fiction to kids, I think is a great idea, because they can read, you know, one story at a time, or they can read several at a time, and I think the shift would be really interesting to give them to experience, because they're so used to reading comic strips that are either super short, you know, one strip at a time, or entire graphic novels, and to break it up with a variety of art and writing and stories sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
So that sounds pretty cool. And the last thing I had is going to be odd, because I'm a bookseller. I'm going to betray my my comrades. And put up as a possible Christmas present a gift certificate to Waitlist Books. I was looking around at a few of the different ebook sites, and it turns out that Waitlist Books actually has gift certificates. You can actually give Waitlist Book individual volumes, or just get gift certificates to give people to spend whatever they want on whatever they want at the site. So people who don't know Waitlist Books, it's a fairly sizable site specializing in speculative fiction, fantasy, fantastica. They have both magazines that you can buy subscriptions to, individual issues. And I think it ranges from, like, the New York Review of Science Fiction Locus. I think I got
Apex,
my Locus subscription there.
Ceaseless yep. Skies, Lightspeed.
BCS, yep, Lightspeed,
exactly.
A
couple others I got. I mean, I've spent way too much money at their site.
See, there you go. There's a ringing endorsement right there.
Yep.
But they also, so you can get subscriptions. You can give people a gift subscription. But they also have a growing gallery of books. And the great thing, again, is that they really seem to run the gamut of stuff. They've got Harold Waldrop's new book, Horse of a Different Color, coming out. Cage Baker. They just a few months ago published several of Michael Sisko's novels in electronic format, but they also have Nnedi Okorafor. They've got all kinds of anthologies. Like, there's a new anthology on fairy tales edited by Paula Guran. There's a lot there. Their offerings just seem, like, every time I go to the site, the offerings just seem to grow and grow. And I thought that might be an interesting option for people to give for Christmas, is just a gift certificate. You know, here you go, buy yourself some books. And there's so much variety, I think it would be easy for people to spend the gift certificate pretty darn quickly.
And if you can load their books onto the Nook, you can load, depending on the format you download, load them onto the Kindle. Some of the Kindle models, you have to do a little hoop jumping. But you don't have to stick with Amazon to buy ebooks, folks.
Right.
Or
exactly.
Barnes & Nobles. This is an excellent alternative.
That's what I thought, and I thought it was a good recommendation for a holiday gift. Especially to people far away, if you don't want to try to mail them something, you can just send them an electronic gift certificate and you're all set.
I once again have to turn in some nerd points here, because I've never even been to that site. So.
Oh, dear me.
Jeff, you're terrible.
I am. I'm awful.
But that's okay.
Excellent. That's a really good list.
That is my list.
Wow. Cool. I've got a few things that are sort of a little bit all over the map here. The top of my personal wish list every year, I am constant, like the moon, is whatever the latest edition of the art collection Spectrum is. And we are on year 20, which is a shocking realization. I've had that on my list. Kathy and Arnie Fenner's collection of art, heavily notated, based on the competition that they do the previous year. This year's edition has a gorgeous cover. I actually saw a physical copy yesterday and chose not to flip through it. I have I have 14 total of the previous editions that I like to flip through on occasion when I need some eye candy, and I am looking forward to it. That is on Amazon. If you have any friends who read the comic book Fables by Bill Willingham and Mark Buckingham, Those two gentlemen, as well as Mr. Jess Nevins, who we have discussed before, have just put out the Fables Encyclopedia, which is basically the compendium of everything that has gone on in that series, which is now in the 130s and is due to end with issue 150, something that makes me very sad.
So they are going to come to an end point then.
Yep. He announced last month it's going to wrap up on 150, which makes me kind of wonder if the fact that the encyclopedia is coming out now means we're not going to have any more additional characters brought into the story, or if they're going to have to re-release it after the end of the series. Apparently this thing, I have not seen it yet. I've only seen the blurbs and the previews that have been online. There is apparently quite a bit of illustration in it. Quite a bit of that illustration is also new. And I think this is a brilliant idea. I think fictional reference books are a thing of mine, and I have quite a few of them. And I find it kind of interesting to see one done for a specific property like this in comics. I had always they made an attempt to do something similar for the portion of the Vertigo universe that was shared between Constantine and the Dreaming and Swamp Thing and stuff like that. But it never really gelled. There was just too many editorial, cooks in the kitchen for that. But this, I really like. I really like the idea of doing it for this particular series, which has always been self-contained. There's only been the one crossover with the series Unwritten, but even then the crossover only occurred in Unwritten. It did not occur in the Fables universe. One of those nerd nuggets of knowledge that I shame myself by knowing. One item that I do want to bring up, which we have already purchased. My wife purchased it the day it came out, and we had it scant days later, is a book called Diableries, Stereoscopic Visions of Hell. And this is by Brian May, the guitarist for Queen, who has, aside from his various astronomy endeavors that he has embarked on in recent years, he has also founded the London Stereoscopic Society, or Stereographic Society. I forget which one it is. One of the two. And they put out a book a few years ago, which was a collection of stereoscopes that were considered to be a lost series about this one particular village in, I believe it was England. And these stereoscopes had been missing for quite a while. And they put this book together, which reproduced them gorgeously. And Brian May had also designed a viewer, a stereoscope viewer, which could be used with the book. You could actually press it up against the pages and adjust for focus. And it was actually a rather ingenious design for a handheld viewer. This new book, which he does with Dennis Pellerin and Paula Fleming, concerns itself with the Diablerie series, which were done in the mid-19th century. And they were originally done by two artists named Henneter and Haubert. I'm probably pronouncing them horribly. And these were two French artists who would build these little sculptures, clay sculptures, of demons and skeletons, portraying various scenes that were going on in hell. Sometimes it was torment, sometimes it was political satire. And that last one is kind of interesting because this was done during the reign of Napoleon. And there was a whole mess of censorship that went on at the time. And quite a few of the models were actually destroyed. They are reproduced beautifully. And there's a lot of satire concerning feminism and censorship and corruption in government. And there's some stuff that is just out and out surrealist. And these are beautiful little scenes that are captured here, and there's a lot of notes that come with them. But a couple interesting things that come out of this book is the fact that the two artists who started them sort of handed the project off to other people after having done several series of these, And as with any franchise, it finds itself in the hands of a new creative team. The series that came after sort of really missed the point or went off in a different direction. And to see, you know, when you see modern fandom complain about things like that these days, and then to see it so beautifully illustrated happening, you know, quite literally in history, where the same thing happened, the satire wasn't the same flavor, the quality of the art wasn't the same. It's just odd that that thing that we consider to be such a modern affectation of fandom, in fact, is not recent at all. So it's a very good book. It is $60 on their site. It is $40 currently on Amazon. It comes with a viewer, which comes in its own case. It comes with a slip cover that has a spectacular lenticular full color version of one of the images of hell on the front. I can't stop looking at it. It's a beautiful little lenticular piece. And highly recommend it. We have both pored over it quite a bit since we received it. I cannot praise it enough. And the last thing I wanted to mention was Asgard Press, which does very nice calendars that normally reproduce old posters. They've done movie posters. They've done comic book covers. They've done vintage calendars for various college football teams, etc. For the past, oh God, it's got to be 7 or 8 years now, they have done a calendar of vintage science fiction covers. These tend to skew normally towards planet stories and occasionally weird tales, though there have been some amazings in there. And they are blown up quite a bit, and they are beautifully reproduced. And they've also done a pretty good job of getting some very obscure covers, but they always tend to be eye candy, and they're always reproduced beautifully. They go through some restoration, and each one of them is suitable for framing, of course. And they are just lovely pieces. And once again, they have a vintage science fiction calendar out this year. And it's one of those things that because you can't have enough covers of planet stories up on your wall, as far as I'm concerned. And that's my list. Fred, what do you got?
I don't know if I can top this or not. Well, I actually am similar in many respects as far as the holidays. I often like to give or receive more art-related books. And this goes back to the mid-70s where there was like this weird serendipity of a bunch of art books coming out for science fiction covers, astounding, as you know, amazing, whatever. Like one I remember was a guy named Franz Rottensteiner, the science fiction book in Illustrated History, which was not much of a history.
Yeah.
But the pictures were just like,
whoa. Beautiful. Yes, I have that.
And then James Gunn came out with Alternate Worlds, the Illustrated History of Science Fiction, which my father was one of the typesetters on, so that's, you know, personal connection.
Really?
Yes, Prentice Hall. So he was a hot type linotype operator.
Wow.
So that's how I got a discount copy.
Excellent.
And
that book as well. So.
Yep, and also around the same time, Lester Del Rey came out with one called Fantastic Science Fiction Art, which was pretty much the stuff, you know, the real pulp, like Science Wonder Stories and Amazing. But, you know, that sort of stuff just I loved. And then,
Loved that book because it was done as a trade paperback.
Right.
And it was so thin, but it had so much in it. It had so many pictures in it.
Yep. And then in high school, I actually took drafting classes, so was very inspired by people like Sid Mead, who worked on Blade Runner and many other things like Tron. But at that point, was just like doing all this concept art for, you know, GE would hire him to do, what's the city of the future going to look like, Mr. Mead? And he's come out with all these wonderful books of collections of his art. So, keeping in mind that I am also getting and probably giving Spectrum number 20, same as Mr. Patterson. But there's also Richard Powers, who was big in the 60s and 70s for book covers, all these weird and wonderful
shapes.
Shapes, yeah. I was going to say like amorphous landscapes. He has there's a collection of his stuff out. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. But it's The Art of Richard Powers from Paper Tiger, which I don't know how I would have gotten through college without Paper Tiger and some of their books and posters and such. There's the another one that I like that I've seen isn't out yet and won't be out, unfortunately, in time for the holidays. But The Art of John Harris, who has done a lot of covers. He's very reminiscent of John Berkey, who was very big in the 70s and 80s. And you probably have seen his stuff, for example, on the serialized novel that John Scalzi did, set in his Old Man's War universe.
Yeah.
He did not only the cover for the eventual actual book, but did a cover for each of the stories that made up that, as Scalzi called it, the season of that story arc. So The Art of John Harris. Another one that won't be out in time for the holidays, but I'm really looking forward to, is The Art of Ian Miller, who I think the first time I came across him was in the paperback edition of Michael Crichton's Eaters of the Dead. He's just got this wonderful style of little, you know, detailed line drawings and, you know, all pen and ink and just wonderful, you know, weird stuff. So I'm glad to see that he's got a good collection coming out. And then my personal investment for the holiday is the omnibus edition of The Sandman, two volumes. Unfortunately, after I bought for myself the omnibus edition in the brown leather covers, I then learned that there is a special edition coming out, signed by Mr. Gaiman, for screamingly hilarious prices. But if I had known about it, I would have, you know, budgeted and bought it, because these are beautiful collections of the series.
They were recolored too. They did
yes.
They did a very nice job of the recoloring of them.
And then I am also buying myself two books by Stephen Baxter, his Zeely series, which started way back when, at the start of his career, with a number of short stories, and then a number of books such as Raft and Time Like Infinity, Flux and Ring. He's got a new, it's a hardcover, but it's probably going to be a short episode called Starfall. And then only, unfortunately, from overseas, but I've ordered it, is a omnibus edition made up of Raft, Time Like Infinity, Flux, and Ring.
Ooh.
And those are books that I wish would come out as ebooks. His later revisiting of the series came out as ebooks eventually, but these haven't. And, you know, as I keep saying to the publishing world, money on the table, because I'd buy them in a second. And the last thing, way back at the dawn of time in 1977, I bought a little pocket game called Ogre.
Ah.
Which was...
And so did I.
Only a few bucks, and it involved a large tank with lots of weapons and lots of little tanks with not so many weapons and little soldiers that got squished very easily. And from Ogre came another game called Gev, or G-E-V. And from that came another game called Shockwave, and then came miniatures and a deluxe edition. And sadly, the game more or less was moribund for a long time. But then Steve Jackson Games, Steve Jackson being the man that owned and did the initial design. And in fact, another friend of mine, Winchell Chung, is the man who gave us the original Ogre artwork.
Ooh.
Kickstarter, Steve Jackson took it to Kickstarter and raised money to come out with the Designer's Edition, which I have received my box, and it is a massive thing, like 28 pounds of game.
Ooh!
And what's really amusing
is
that
huge.
When I opened it up, inside the box is what they call the Pocket Edition, which is basically a reprint of the original.
Oh, man.
So you've got this little tiny envelope sitting next to this huge box, which, I mean, this thing has got to be seen to be believed how huge it is. I will have to devote, like, a room just to setting up the board because I don't think it can fit on the table.
As it should be.
I just remember getting those envelopes in the mail back then and just opening them up and just spreading everything out on a table and just staring at it and reading it. And weeks would pass before I actually played the game. You know, I just immersed myself in all of the detail and minutiae that came with it.
Well, Ogre, I mean, I played it in college and I brought it with me to basic training in the Army. And played it there, and I brought it with me into the field and played it in the field. And another friend of mine, Steve Davidson, and I even proposed to Steve Jackson a module. Steve Davidson is actually now the publisher of the revived Amazing magazine, Amazing Stories. So, this is like one of the titles that I've had, the longest. And played the most. So I'm very, very happy to see this come back into print.
Yeah.
In such a big way.
Yes.
So that'll do it for me.
We're showing our age.
Yes. That's okay.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Excellent. Excellent. That's a really good... That's a good Christmas right there is what that is.
Yeah. Maybe I'll set the ogre up underneath the tree instead of a train.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would complain.
Oh, last year my daughter did her hex bugs. Hex bug track.
Oh, that's funny. Great. Well, I hope we've given some people some good ideas. Because I know you gentlemen have certainly given me some, so I'm going to pursue that. We will have links to everything on the show notes. As usual, I wanted to go around, see what you boys have been enjoying lately. John, what do you got?
What have I got? besides reading a lot of stuff on white, connections in the brain, white matter connections in the brain, actual stuff more relevant would be, I've read a couple of novels, the one that I will discuss here is actually not technically a science fiction, fantasy, whatever novel, but it does involve magic, and it's Nick Mamatis's Love is the Law, which is, I think, Dark Horse put out for him. It's not a long novel. It's quick. It's brutal. It's very well done. I mean, Nick is really an incredibly strong writer. He, his prose is always very crisp, to the point, but he's really got a knack for how to unnerve you, and he's really got a knack for drawing people into the story at the same time, so even if you're being squicked out or annoyed at something, you can't stop reading. It's a very potent formula. And this book is about a young woman living on Long Island, a teenager. Who is a Trotskyite and also a practitioner of sort of Crowleyan magic. And it's basically a mystery story of her trying to find out who killed her mentor. But what it's really about is the way that magical thinking works in our lives. And this narrator is really the perfect delivery system for a much broader philosophical discussion of the way that ideology influences the way you look at the world, to the point where it can sometimes put things into sharp focus and other times completely obfuscate them. So it's a very impressive book. I really liked it a lot. I have to write a review fairly soon for it, I think. But I highly recommend it. And then actually the next one is one I'm working on now. It's actually a short story collection. About halfway through, it's Molly Tanzer's A Pretty Mouth, which is sort of a collection of Lovecraft meets Wodehouse stories. That's the impression I've got so far. It's a little uneven. There's not... The consistency varies a bit between stories. but it's very enjoyable to read. I'm really liking it so far, and I'm looking forward to finishing that off. And then on a completely unrelated note to anything to do with fandom, I read a wildlife monograph on snow monkeys by a woman named Heather Angel, who's a wildlife photographer. And actually, it's something that I think people should read if they want to talk about using animals in a secondary world in a different environment, because there's only one place in the world where there are snow monkeys, which is a small area of Japan, mountainous area of Japan. And it's really interesting to read about how these monkeys adapted to this very uncommon environment for that type of animal. Mm. And the pictures are hilarious. I put a few up on my Tumblr. I'll put the link on the show notes. It's a really fun book to read. It doesn't take that long. There's not a lot of text to it. There's a lot of great photos. And it was just a lot of fun to read and could be relevant if you're, you know, trying to look at wildlife from a different angle.
I've always said that anything, and I mean anything in real life or in fiction, can be improved with either monkeys or a sword fight.
So. Yes, well, that's her next volume is Samurai Monkeys, I'm sure.
I was about to say, yeah, and if it's monkeys having sword fights, that's even better. That's just...
In the snow, yeah.
That's right. We're done. We've finished. Culture itself has achieved its zenith. We can just evolve and die off now.
Excellent.
Fred, what are you consuming?
Well, I am... actually reading a book I just picked up yesterday, and I tweeted several pictures while I was buying it. It's a gentleman named Paul Eli, E-L-I-E, who wrote a book called The Life You Save May Be Your Own. And this book is called Reinventing Bach, which is about how Bach moved from being, you know, church music, and pretty obscure church music, to someone like Douglas Hofstetter writes Golda Lesterbach about, or gets mentioned in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, or mm-hmm. you know, all sorts of other places that he's shown up in. I mean, it talks about Glenn Gould, not only the initial recording that Glenn Gould did of the Goldberg Variations, but then revisiting it 30 years later in the 80s. Yo-Yo Ma, all sorts of people that, you know, names you'll recognize or things you'll recognize, and how far Bach has spread. Mm. I mean, even you know, the first song played on an iPad during one of Steve Jobs's presentations was a piece by Bach. Mm. You know, in order to demonstrate the iTunes Store app or something like that. And the CD, there was actually. If they had gotten their act together, there would have been a Bach release, would have been the first thing, but the two companies coming out with the initial CDs, one went with, I think, a more of a poppy thing than Bach, but, you know, it's just interesting to see how many places he's shown up.
Hmm.
So, not very science fictional, but...
No, it's okay.
Interesting nonetheless.
Cool. I'm just remembering my copy of a Well-Tempered Synthesizer from...
Yep.
Whatever.
Walter and Wendy.
Yep. I forget who. So, cool.
And you?
A couple of things I wanted to mention. Number one, I've been reading the latest issue of Asimov's. Had a couple of very good shorter stories involving time travel that I really liked. But the thing that stood out for me so far is the novelette Primes by Ron Collins. Very interesting story about rather invasive ways that advertising can be streamed and how those ways can be exploited for less than noble motivations. And it's interesting because it has several POV characters in it, and each one is sort of identified via the prime numbers in their life. And it's surprisingly successful method of conveying information, which I thought was kind of clever. Read that a couple days ago. Really enjoyed it. Been reading, finally caught up with the current limited series Doctor Who Prisoners of Time, which is the comic book that is sort of the 50th anniversary comic that's coming out. Issue 11 just came out, and each issue has sort of dealt with one of the various incarnations of the Doctor and this sort of compounding mystery that has been going on through time, and it's coming to a culmination, and it just hit its big cliffhanger, so we'll see what happens in issue 12, but all the issues so far have been very good. The art, as with a lot of the Doctor Who books, tends to be hit or miss, but I think they've captured the likenesses of most of the actors playing the Doctors and the Companions quite well. And it's been rather nifty, you know. As always, there's things you can do on comics you can't always do on TV. So,
I was interested to note that with the mention of the Sisterhood in the minisode that came out this week with
Paul McGann
and also John Hurt, the episode that they're mentioned in The Brain of Morbius has been sold out. Like on Amazon and other places.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
So everybody's like, "Oh, this is from the past. I need to see that episode."
Hey, like you said, it's a way to make money. So.
Yep.
Just want to mention, I just started the audiobook of Robert Charles Wilson's Burning Paradise, and am hooked, ridiculously hooked, as I am with most Robert Charles Wilson books. It's a parallel universe where after the invention of radio, humanity found itself being mollified by external forces. So a lot of things that happened in our history did not happen to them. And, very, very good so far. Kind of creepy. And, as always, very science fictional. Huge, huge, Wilson fan here. So. All right. I think that's a wrap, gentlemen.
Yep.
All right.
We are going to continue trying to... We are going to be talking about some books in the near future, as well as a couple other subjects. And we hope you will chime in. Let us know how we're doing. And hope we make this interesting for everybody. We will see you all next month. Have a good evening.
Good night.
Yep. Good night.